loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. A Department of Defense report on the U.S. strategy in combating the so-called Islamic State is due early this week. Will the United States dramatically escalate its military presence in Iraq and Syria? More ground troops, stepped-up bombings, and so-called safe zones all appear to be on the table. To explore this issue, we are joined today for the full hour from London by Alexander Mercuris. He is the editor-in-chief of The Duran. We are also joined from New York City by Ben Norton. He is currently a contributor to Alternet's Gray Zone project. Welcome back, Alexander and Ben.
Hello. How are you?
Very good. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thanks, both of you, for joining. It's a big issue. Tomorrow, Donald Trump will speak before both houses of Congress. It'll be a nationally televised speech. It's also the time that will be the deadline for General James Mattis to give Donald Trump his report on what is to be done regarding U.S. strategy towards Daesh or the so-called Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Obviously, Mattis's report has been timed to coincide with Trump's speech. So obviously, the U.S. government, the U.S. media, the Pentagon are prepped for an announcement about perhaps a big change or maybe a modest change. We'll talk about that in Iraq-Syria policy. Alexander Mercuris, the Pentagon is set to deliver a plan to President Trump, as I said, as early as today, on combat against the so-called Islamic State. What do you expect to be in that report? Is this a major shift from Obama policy?
I think there will be a shift from the previous administration's policy, from the Obama administration's policy. But President Trump has made defeating the Islamic State, Daesh, a very high priority. He's talked about wiping jihadi terrorism off the face of the earth, and it's quite clear that he's actually focusing very heavily on defeating Daesh. Now, I don't think the Obama administration gave it quite the same kind of priority. The problem is that the details of what the Trump administration is going to do and what General Mattis is going to advise President Trump that they should do is at the moment far from clear. We've had all these references to safe zones, to more troops being sent to the area. We'll just have to see how this all gels together and what sort of a strategy it is going to be. But my guess is that we're going to see quite a significant escalation of U.S. effort in the area, and that unfortunately also means a much greater U.S. presence in the area, which could have all kinds of consequences.
Ben Norton, same question to you. Is this going to be a big escalation? Obama came into the White House on January 20th, 2009, with the promise to the electorate, especially to those who had voted for him, that the U.S. would leave Iraq. Here we are, 8+ years later. The U.S. has not left Iraq. Well, it left, but it came back in a big way. And there is now an open-ended aerial war. Will there be an escalating ground war?
It's hard to say at this point. You know, as Alex alluded to, there are many options on the table. And in fact, General Joseph Dunford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, explicitly said that all the options are still on the table. That's the language he used. And one of those options is more troops. He even said that they're considering sending troops into Syria. So, I mean, as you mentioned, the U.S. has some 6,000 troops already in Iraq. The U.S., of course, has special operations forces on the ground in Syria, which are very, you know, little discussed. You know, people always often ask if the U.S. is going to send ground troops as if there aren't some already. But there have been special operations forces for a while now. And I mean, to also get to the question you had asked Alex a moment ago, you know, it's hard to tell, but I actually am skeptical of the notion that Trump will change policy significantly. In fact, Spencer Ackerman, a reporter at The Guardian, who, you know, has done a lot of work on the drone program and you know, he's done a lot of work critical of the national security state in the U.S., he published a big story this week that basically argued that the U.S. military is going to retain what he said is the core strategy that the Obama administration was using against ISIS. So we may see some differences, but I think at the end of the day, I think Trump claimed that he's going to come in and change policy significantly. But when I think you look at the policy toward Iran, the policy toward Saudi Arabia, the policy toward Israel, those are all the same. And there are a few differences. If anything, he's moving in a more hawkish direction. And I anticipate that in the wars in Iraq and Syria, I don't think we'll see a huge policy shift. It will just be more of the usual, but maybe a perhaps more extreme version of what's been going on for the past several years.
Alexander Mercuris, Lieutenant General Stephen Townsend, who's in charge of the Iraq-Syria operation for U.S. CENTCOM, Central Command, which is the command for the Pentagon in the Middle East. He's been making the point very, very visibly in the media in the last few days that American troops are closer and closer to the front lines, that in fact the Americans have suffered casualties, not deaths necessarily, but people being wounded. Of course, the Obama administration sent the U.S. soldiers will not see combat, that they're going to go in for training and assistance of the Iraqi military. But now Townsend is saying, no, we're moving closer and closer to the front lines. We have to embed U.S. troops. Of course, Iraq is still leading. But it seemed to me that the admission by the Pentagon that they're doing this, which may have been something they've been doing all along, but the admission of it had a political piece to it. And the political piece is that it's preparation for Mattis's report and Trump's announcement on Tuesday, February 28th. In other words, preparing public opinion for a possible escalation of some type. What do you think?
I agree. I mean, I think that the United States and its troops in the area have been actually conducting command and control roles, if one can use that expression, in Iraq, certainly, and amongst the Iraqi army for a long time. Certainly since the present offensive against ISIS, against Daesh, in and around Mosul got underway back in October. I don't think there's any doubt about that. To that extent, they have definitely been on the front line for some time. As Ben said, they've also been in Syria. There's been U.S. special forces in Syria. They've been heavily involved with the Kurdish militia, the YPG, that's fighting Daesh in and around Raqqa. So they've been filling roles there too. What is important, as you again rightly say, is that this fact is now being actually publicized, that the administration is coming out and publicly saying that this is happening. And I think this is partly to give an impression, to prepare the ground for more, but it is also partly, I think, intended to say, to make it more visible that the United States is doing all of these things, which it has been doing for some time. And I think the reason why it wants to make that more visible is because of the kind of political commitment that the United States under Donald Trump has made, which is to defeat ISIS. So I think that even if there's not going to be as much of a change as perhaps some might have expected, I think the appearance of a change, the appearance that the United States is more involved in fighting Daesh, is important for the Trump administration, and that is why all these comments about the involvement of U.S. troops are being made now. But I have to say, I also think that we will be seeing some kind of an escalation, and I suspect that will not just involve ground troops. I suspect we will see a very sustained bombing offensive at the very least as well.
During the election campaign, Ben Norton, I think it was back in March 2016, Donald Trump said he would absolutely, definitely escalate the involvement of the U.S. in Iraq and Syria. He said, we will send 20 to 30,000 troops. He said, I will do what the generals tell me, but I'm hearing numbers. I'm hearing the numbers 20,000 to 30,000. Now, that's a lot of troops. I don't know if that I do know that's not a decisive number to turn the tide of battle in Iraq, 20 to 30,000. But it is it's a bigger number. And what makes it bigger, maybe not so much militarily, but politically, is that if you deploy 20 to 30,000 troops, some of them will get shot. Some of them will be killed. Right now, the Pentagon refuses to release the numbers or the names of people who have been wounded. Certainly, that shows sensitivity on the part of the Pentagon to public opinion. It would seem to me that if 20,000 to 30,000 U.S. troops were to be sent to Iraq, and some of them started dying, which they, as I said, would unnecessarily, that could blow back on Trump in terms of domestic public opinion in the United States, because there is, in fact, no appetite in American public opinion for a larger ground war in Iraq. I mean, that's the way it seems to me. What do you think, Ben?
Well, I think yes and no. It's a little more nuanced in the sense that, I mean, if you look at polls, this is true for years, actually. And this is one of the reasons the Obama administration's policy in Syria was particularly ridiculous. Not that foreign policy in the U.S. is ever based on what people who live here actually want, but poll after poll showed for years, at least since 2014, that Americans were much more concerned about ISIS and other extremist groups than they were about the Syrian government, when the U.S. government was more committed, at least for the first few years of the rise of ISIS in 2014 and 2015, to the defeat of the Syrian government. And now, you know, the U.S. government now claims that it is no longer interested in regime change. I mean, we'll see. I mean, I'm always skeptical of that. And just because Trump himself may be opposed to regime change doesn't mean elements of the U.S. state are not still pursuing regime change. But that aside, if you look at polls, people are certainly critical. Americans are certainly critical of the notion that the U.S. would send more troops to any part of the Middle East, excluding the fight against ISIS. And actually, there is some support for more of a sustained military presence to fight ISIS. Whether or not that's a good idea is, of course, a very different question. But I mean, I think, yeah, there's no question that it could potentially in some ways backfire. But as you mentioned, in any kind of violent conflict, casualties are inevitable. And if Trump is looking for more ground troops for any conflict in the world, this is by far the easiest one to pitch. And again, I mean, ISIS is a horrific genocidal group. And Americans are well aware of that. I mean, Trump campaigned fear-mongering about ISIS. I mean, we can argue whether or not the threat of ISIS is overblown. I would say in some ways it is overblown, even though it is a horrific genocidal group. But yeah, I mean, it could backfire, but I don't think actually it will backfire in any significant way. I mean, I think that would be a relatively popular war.
Alexander, same question to you. I want to get your take on it. Of course, Ben is in New York, so presumably he should know, because you're in faraway London. But I'm
faraway London.
But go ahead.
For what it's worth, I think that President Trump, or at least his advisors, those of them who are on the political side, will be extremely wary of going down that road. Yes, I do agree that lots of people in the United States are strongly opposed to Daesh. And if there is, as Ben says, any constituency for sending ground troops anywhere, it is to fight Daesh. Nonetheless, I think on balance, this would be a hugely unpopular move with many people. It would not be a popular move, certainly in Britain, which was, of course, involved in the previous wars. And I would be surprised, personally, if it would be a popular move in the United States. And it is so easy to see how that could go horribly wrong if casualties pile up, if a resistance on the part of Daesh actually strengthens, because, of course, Daesh would now have the Western Christian Crusader army that it's been talking about fighting for a long time, and that might actually stiffen its resistance. And this, of course, brings us to the next point. I not only do I not think it would be politically wise from the domestic point of view, but I don't think it would be wise from the situation in the Middle East as well. I think that it would play into Daesh's hands, and I don't think it is necessary. If one is looking at the fighting that is going on at the moment in the Middle East, it seems to me that Daesh is on the retreat. It's being pressured in Mosul. It's been pressured in Raqqa. It seems to be suffering defeats in all sorts of places. Now, I am not suggesting that it is on the brink of collapse or anything like that. But I just don't myself think that the political risks of sending U.S. troops there, the advantages of doing that outweigh the political risks of doing it. And I suspect that President Trump's advisors, both his civilian advisors and I think ultimately many of his military advisors, will so advise him. So I don't personally think it will happen. I may be wrong. We shall see.
Okay, that's the voice of Alexander Mercuris. He's the editor-in-chief of The Duran in London. We're also talking with Ben Norton. He's the contributor to Alternet's Gray Zone. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're speaking with Ben Norton from Alternet's Gray Zone Project in New York City and with Alexander Mercuris, the editor-in-chief of The Duran. Alexander is in London. We're talking about the announcement coming soon of a new U.S. strategy in Iraq and Syria, a new strategy to fight the Islamic State or Daesh. And we're talking on the day before, the eve of President Donald Trump's major speech before both houses of Congress, where he will unnecessarily unveil not only domestic policy positions, but a foreign policy which we or he will undoubtedly want to make distinctive from or different from that of President Barack Obama. Ben Norton, before we went to break, Alexander Mercuris was making the point that not only would an escalation of U.S. military intervention in Iraq go badly in the United States or with U.S. public opinion, but it might be counterproductive in Iraq itself. It might stiffen the resolve, he said, of ISIS fighters. It might play into their narrative that this is, in fact, a clash of civilizations, that it's a war by crusader Western imperialist armies against Islam. What do you think about that point?
Well, I think it's absolutely correct. And what I wanted to clarify, when I said earlier that there might be substantial support in the U.S. for sending ground troops to fight ISIS, I was not saying that that's a good idea by any stretch of the imagination. I think it would be a horrific idea, and I agree with Alex's analysis. But, I mean, this is actually a matter of record, and there haven't been many polls done in the past year. But about a year ago, during the presidential campaign, there was substantial polling done of American opinion about sending ground troops to fight ISIS. And the polls varied, of course, but many of them found that slightly more than half and maybe as many as two-thirds of Americans would have supported the policy. And again, I think that's a bad thing. It's, to me, absurd that Americans would think that the U.S. can solve a problem in the Middle East by sending more ground troops, considering we still have, you know, thousands of troops in Afghanistan. I mean, that's not the Middle East, it's South Asia. But, you know, this is a 16-year war that is getting worse and worse. So, yes, of course, I think the notion that the U.S. can send, you know, however many troops to Iraq and Syria and solve this problem is absurd. And I think Alex articulated some good reasons why, but I think it's even more than just that. When you look at the reason that ISIS exists in the first place, the reason that al-Qaeda metastasized throughout Iraq, it's because of the presence of U.S. troops. It's because the U.S. overthrew the Iraqi government in violation of international law. It's because the U.S. carried out a sectarian war and occupation of Iraq for a decade. It's because the U.S. killed thousands of civilians and unleashed terror upon the Iraqi population. It's because the U.S. disbanded the Iraqi army and de-Baathized the Iraqi state. You know, these are all policies that helped fuel the rise of this genocidal group. And then, of course, you can look to Syria, which is a whole other can of worms. But the notion that even if the U.S. had benevolent interests, which it certainly doesn't, but even if it did have benevolent interests and only wanted to fight ISIS and only for purely benevolent humanitarian reasons, just looking at what happened in Iraq in the past decade, I think should really belie the notion that the U.S., even if it wanted to, could make things better. Again, and when you look at the way that ISIS and al-Qaeda, the way they recruit more people, this absolutely confirms their narrative, as you mentioned, that you have the crusaders from the West coming to fight us. At the end of the day, the only forces that are going to be able to defeat ISIS permanently, and then, of course, the other extremist groups like al-Qaeda, are domestic forces. you cannot have some kind of foreign army that just comes in and quashes them and expects the support for them that exists to go away. Because ISIS is not just a military problem, it's a political problem. And there are particular political reasons that, unfortunately, there are some Sunni communities that welcomed them in. And that's a whole other conversation in and of itself. But you can't just send American troops to crush that. You have to have an inclusive government. You have to have some kind of representation. You have to stop the scourge of sectarianism, which is being fueled not just by these extremist groups, but also by U.S. allies, namely the Gulf states of Saudi Arabia and Qatar, you know, these theocratic Wahhabi monarchies. There are a variety of factors involved, and the most important factors to defeating extremist groups like this are the political ones. So if we only talk about military solutions, especially external military solutions, the problem is only going to continue to fester on and on and on.
Alexander, when Ben was speaking, I was just thinking about the big picture here and the historical picture. The United States has been at war against Iraq, a small country, you know, a country of less than 30 million people. It was bombing Iraq in February 1991. That was 25 years ago. Then it imposed economic sanctions for the next 12 or 13 years. According to the UN's own statistics, more than a million Iraqis died, 8,000 per month, 8,000, 5,000 of whom were children under the age of five, vulnerable kids who were dying because they couldn't get medicine to treat waterborne diseases or bacteria, and the bacteria was there because the U.S. also, through the U.N., deprived Iraq of having that which it needed to sustain civilian water systems. Then Bill Clinton declared that regime change, not controlling weapons of mass destruction, was the main goal of the United States, and that was signed by Congress, approved unanimously by the U.S. Senate, and signed into law by Clinton, who then began the bombing of Iraq every day, starting in December 1998. And then George W. Bush announces the shock and awe invasion, and that happens. And then there's a military occupation, and Barack Obama finally says, well, we're bringing it all to an end. But then he resumes the bombing campaign because there's a new reason to bomb, this time now ISIS, which didn't yet exist before. And now Donald Trump says, well, we're going to be stronger than Obama. We're going to really wipe out ISIS in Iraq. I mean, so it's now five administrations in a row bombing Iraq as if there is some sort of military solution from the United States, which was like a wrecking ball in this country. I mean, it's just astonishing when you think about the historical record. I mean, Iraq did nothing to America.
It is absolutely astonishing, and it is appalling. It is a terrible thing, and one should not overlook the terrible crime, because that is the correct word, that has been visited on these unhappy people in Iraq. Their society and their community, one of the most ancient societies in the world, Iraq is a place with possibly the oldest continuity of civilization in the world, has been wrecked by almost continuous war, visited upon it, and as you rightly say, the reasons for continuing with these wars continuously changes. There's always some further reason. Either it's to defeat Saddam Hussein's aggression, or it is to deal with his weapons of mass destruction, which don't exist, or it is to impose some sort of peace on the country because of the sectarian wars that we've created, or it is to fight ISIS. And now this is the latest iteration of this. And, of course, the other thing about this is that it has been a completely misconceived policy from the U.S. point of view as well. It is very difficult to see that the United States has achieved any benefit whatever from this constant involvement in Iraq. It has just been a massive drain in treasure and blood, which has strengthened the U.S. position globally, not at all. It has only brought trouble in its wake, but it seems that in the United States there is no ability to learn from this and no ability to change course. Always the reflex seems to be, if the problems continue, to double down and to go on doing that which has been done for the last 25 years and which has repeatedly and disastrously and catastrophically failed.
Those are interesting points, Ben Norton, that Alexander Mercuris just made, that the United States has actually gained nothing, meaning the U.S., I don't mean the American people, I mean the U.S. system, the U.S. global sort of empire, whatever you want to call it, the imperial empire of the United States, that they went in, and I can remember this vividly because during the anti-war movement, which here in the United States, as one of the leaders of the Answer Coalition, I helped organize, you know, hundreds of thousands of people every month coming out. People were chanting, no war for oil, no war for oil. Same in 1991, no war for oil. That was the chant. There was a kind of consciousness that this was an imperial adventure to gobble up Iraq's resources. And of course, Iraq had the second largest oil reserves in the Middle East, which had 2/3 of the world's middle oil resources. So that sort of made sense. But at the end of the day, when you look back at when 2011 and 2012, midterm, after Obama had been in office for a couple of years, the oil contracts in Iraq were not actually going to ExxonMobil or to U.S. oil companies. A lot of them were going to Chinese oil companies because China was offering the newly emerging and somewhat sovereign Iraqi government better deals than the U.S. oil companies, because China was actually pursuing a developmental strategy, not simply like maximizing profits. So they were getting better terms. In other words, has the entire escapade actually been a complete failure from the point of view of imperial interests?
I would say yes or no. And to briefly answer that before, you know, getting into the historical details, we should also remember that there's no question that the U.S. is the largest empire in the world. It's the largest empire in history. But it's also not infallible. It's very much fallible. And what this demonstrates over the past, you know, 26 years now in Iraq is that the U.S. may have particular interests and it may be looking to get something out of its military intervention in other countries, but it cannot control all the factors. And sometimes things really blow up in its face. And I think that it's pretty accurate to say that things have absolutely blown up in the face of the U.S. empire. But at the same time, I mean, I agree with the majority of Alex's analysis. I mean, the pain and suffering that the U.S. has unleashed on Iraq in the past, not just 25 and 26, but the past 30, 35, 36, at this point, 37 years is horrific and unbelievable. Because the U.S. involvement in Iraq, of course, it goes back to the Cold War and CIA involvement in overthrowing different Iraqi governments, etc. But really, in terms of violent conflict, it especially goes back to the 1980s when Saddam was the U.S. man in Iraq, when Saddam was fighting a war against Iran after the 1979 Iranian Revolution. Saddam Hussein was a close U.S. ally. He was receiving U.S. weapons, including chemical weapons that he used against Iranians in war crimes. The U.S., we now know, was giving intelligence to Saddam when he used those weapons. The Iran-Iraq war, I mean, it was especially horrific for Iran, but it was also horrific for Iraq, and it led to the death of more than 1 million people. And Henry Kissinger famously said, you know, the former U.S. National Security Advisor, who's, you know, ubiquitous and has been ubiquitous throughout the U.S. government for 50 years now, Kissinger infamously said that he wished both sides could lose of the Iran-Iraq war. And, you know, you fast forward from the Gulf War, as you mentioned, you know, the genocidal sanctions. Dennis Halliday, the former UN humanitarian coordinator for Iraq, who previously oversaw the UN sanctions that were imposed by the U.S. on Iraq, he called those sanctions genocidal. And he resigned from his post at the UN after years of working there in protest of those genocidal sanctions. And then, of course, as you mentioned, I mean, leading up to the Iraq war, et cetera, it's important to understand that this has led to the death of somewhere around 3 million Iraqis. It really is an unspeakably horrific crime. That said, you know, this was not done for no reason. As you mentioned, Iraq has enormous oil resources. Also, Saddam Hussein was not willing to play ball. I mean, there's no question that Saddam Hussein was a repressive dictator, but he was also not willing to play ball. He was not, you know, kowtowing to the Washington consensus. And he, especially in the Middle East, especially when it came to issues like Israel, I mean, he was not necessarily doing what the U.S. wanted him to do. And there are a variety of reasons they ousted him. But when you look at the question of oil, I've actually done some reporting on this. It's very interesting to look at U.S. government documents in regard to oil in Iraq. In fact, the U.S. Energy Information Administration, the EIA, has openly on their website, they have a graph that shows Iraq's petroleum production over the years. And what's interesting about this graph is if you look at it, it shows that in the 1990s, when the U.S., well, when the U.N., but it was mostly the U.S., imposed one of the most harsh sanctioned regimes in history on Iraq, which basically prevented it from selling its oil throughout the world, the production of oil in Iraq was basically the same as its domestic consumption. But when then you fast forward to the UN Oil for Food program, and then you fast forward to the Iraq War, and you look at the graph on the U.S. government's own website, it shows that oil production skyrockets from the 1990s by 800% up till today, and it continuously increases again and again and again. So there's no question that the U.S. wanted Iraq to vastly increase its oil production and its oil exports in particular, because most of these exports are going abroad. I mean, most of the oil production is going into exports. If you look at the consumption, it hasn't changed that much. So the question, of course, is where are those exports going? And you hit the nail on the head. Ironically, a lot of those exports are going to India, China, and South Korea, which are the main sources in Asia. I mean, the U.S. is certainly getting some. Europe is certainly getting some of Iraq's oil. But this also makes us we have to problematize what imperialism is, because imperialism is not just I invade you and take your oil. Imperialism in a capitalist system is more complex than that. It's also about forcing isolated countries to open their markets to foreign capital, which is absolutely what has happened in Iraq. Basra, which is not talked about as much as places like Baghdad or Mosul, Basra, which is the main oil hub in Iraq, which was actually occupied by the British mostly. There were American troops, but it was largely a British hub. Basra has not seen as much fighting as other parts of Iraq. Oil has continued to flow. And in fact, when ISIS was taking over territories, the U.S. and Western allies were more concerned about Basra. So, yeah, I mean, it's true that the U.S. is not necessarily buying all of this oil, but this is part of a larger global capitalist system. And we shouldn't argue that, oh, well, you know, the U.S. is not benefiting from it. I mean, the global capitalist system is benefiting from it. Iraq's economy is now this very corrupt neoliberal state that is essentially allowing countries around the world to purchase its oil for pretty cheaply.
Let's leave it there. We're going to go to a break. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're talking about Donald Trump's expected announcement about a new foreign policy towards Iraq and Syria, a new military policy. Donald Trump will be speaking tomorrow to the nation and to both houses of Congress. We're joined from London by Alexander Mercuris. He is the editor-in-chief of the Duran. And from New York City by Ben Norton. He is currently a contributor to Alternet's Gray Zone Project. Alexander, before we went to break, Ben Norton was talking about the complexity of how U.S. military strategy in Iraq has also intertangled with economic policies, who benefits, who doesn't benefit, whether the plan for Iraq worked or didn't work. As you said and made the point earlier in the interview, that in many ways it's come to nothing for the United States. Ben Norton was making the point, well, maybe we shouldn't look at just simply whether the U.S. got oil contracts or whether the U.S. got a proxy government. The overall impact has actually been in some ways beneficial to a world economic order that the U.S. still currently dominates. What's your take on all that?
Yes, I think one must make a distinction between the political and geostrategic position of the United States and the private interests of certain people who are operating and are the main beneficiaries of the world economic system. Certainly, one can say that increasing Iraqi oil production and bringing it under the control, if you will, of the international oil industry has benefited certain players within the economic system, the present world economic system. If one is, however, looking at this from a rather different point of view, which is looking at the question of U.S. prestige, U.S. diplomatic strength, the appearance of U.S. power, the way in which the United States is perceived around the world as a great power. I cannot myself see how this has benefited the United States. What the conflict in Iraq has done is that it has demonstrated the limits of U.S. power and the degree to which the U.S. is unable to manipulate the situations and to control them, even in relatively small and confined places like Iraq, to the extent that it wants to. And if one can take back a few things that Ben was saying, the United States built up Saddam Hussein, as he correctly says, to counter Iran. And then what it found after it did that is that it had to bring him down again, and it chose to do that by sending an army there. And then after that, what it found is that it had created another monster in the form of Daesh. And now it's talking about sending its army to Iraq again to do that all over again. I cannot see how that can be considered a successful policy. By any measure, it has been a disaster. And it has been a disaster primarily for the United States itself. Well, not primarily for the United States, but also primarily for the Iraqi people, but also for the United States. The problem is the United States just doesn't seem to be able to learn from this. Surely the United States could negotiate oil contracts with a viable and successful Iraqi government without having to interfere continuously in Iraqi affairs if it were prepared to leave Iraq alone to settle its own affairs. And I am confident that if that were to happen, Iraq would in time settle its own affairs. Exactly as Ben was saying, it is U.S. interference in Iraq which is creating monsters like previously Saddam Hussein and now ISIS.
Ben Norton, I want to jump in with a slightly different but not contradictory idea or thesis to the one that you have presented, which is that Saddam Hussein did not actually present an obstacle to the United States or to the domination of U.S. corporate and military power. That Saddam Hussein was, in fact, as he signaled in during the Iran-Iraq War, and as you rightly pointed out, served as in many ways as an extension of American strategy to weaken the Iranian Revolution. But I believe that what was actually happening in 1990 was that the Soviet power was diminishing. It Soviet Union hadn't yet disappeared, but it was on the trajectory of disappearing. Its Eastern and Central European allies had gone. Gorbachev had said the end of, you know, by the proclamation of universal human values instead of other sort of Marxian concepts like class struggle or anti-imperialism, that the Soviet policy now would be to make peace with the United States at any cost. And it was willing to sacrifice its allies in Eastern Europe and Central Europe and its allies in the Middle East, because it was at that time that Bush went ahead and instead of having a negotiated solution to the invasion of Kuwait by Saddam in August 1990, which could have been done, could have easily been done, a negotiated settlement, the Bush team saw this as an opportunity, given the absence of a Soviet counterbalance, to do what it had wanted to do, which was to show the world, to demonstrate to the world the absolute primacy of U.S. military power. And so it used it for the first time like that, sending U.S. ground troops into the Arab world, and it did it successfully, and it was a short war. And so that sort of gave a new sort of hubris and arrogance to U.S. policy. And now, in the absence of the Soviet Union, there was a determination made that all of the independent nationalist post-colonial projects that had taken the form of state power, be they in Syria, Iraq, Iran, or wherever, that they were going to be demolished by the U.S., not because they were really an obstacle to the United States' economic designs, but because the U.S. could smash them and could crush them and thus show to the world that there was this new unrivaled unipolar power. In other words, it was for demonstration purposes. What do you think about that?
I think that's absolutely right. And, I mean, of course, I wasn't necessarily saying that they challenged U.S. power in a kind of military way, because, again, the U.S. military is unparalleled, absolutely. I mean, this is also the irony of all this fear-mongering about Russia. I mean, the U.S. currently spends more on its military than the next seven largest countries combined, including China. I mean, the U.S. has, we don't even know how many military bases, but probably some 800 military bases around the world. The U.S. has military forces in 150 countries. So there's no question that Iraq posed a threat to U.S. military power. Absolutely. I mean, I agree. I think your analysis is absolutely complimentary. We now know, actually, this is a recent revelation. Several months ago, a former CIA analyst who wrote a book about his experience interrogating Saddam Hussein said in an almost comical but still somewhat horrific way that when the U.S. was invading Iraq in 2003, Saddam was not only was he not working in weapons of mass destruction, he basically wasn't even really in power anymore, and he was focusing on writing a novel. He had largely retreated from his political life and you know, was carrying out literary pursuits. So certainly, I mean, it wasn't that he was, you know, this staunch principled anti-imperialist threatening U.S. power. It's that, you know, the existence of these countries that were outside of the Washington consensus, that did not adopt explicit neoliberal policies, that did not completely kowtow on the international stage and simply go along with what was ordered. I mean, they were symbolic, even if they were not actual military threats. And, you know, this is true of Gaddafi's Libya, et cetera. You can go down the list. I mean, going back to 1990, it's really an interesting historical discussion because a former U.S. diplomat, April Glaspie, famously argued, and she actually may be 100% correct. I mean, historians argue this, but she argued from her experience inside, the U.S. state working as a diplomat, that the U.S. actually wanted Saddam to go into Kuwait and that people inside the U.S. government coaxed him into invading Kuwait, giving him the impression that they would support him. So, I mean, these are interesting historical discussions, and there's no question. I mean, I think you hit the analysis straight in the, hit the nail straight in the head. And I'll add just one more quick point here. In regard to oil production, I mean, it's not even just empty speculation. I mean, I wrote a report several months ago for Salon when there were leaks of Hillary Clinton's emails as former Secretary of State. And there was an email that was sent several years ago when, I mean, this is before 2013, the so-called end of the U.S. war in Iraq. And in the email, I mean, I wrote about it for Salon, and anyone who's interested can look up the exact language of the email. But essentially what it was, it was an email to Secretary of State Clinton from U.S. State Department officials that said that they wanted Iraq to continually increase its oil production. And they said that they wanted Iraq to create oil to, quote, pay the greatest dividends. And they pointed out that Iraq was potentially one of the largest oil producers in the world. And they said that in the next 5 years, they wanted to increase Iraq's oil production by 150%. And in less than 5 years, behold, Iraq had increased its oil production by 175%, exceeding their goal. So, I mean, we have documents now that show that the U.S. was explicitly pushing for Iraq post-invasion to vastly increase its output of oil production.
Alexander Mercuris, I want to turn, and we have about 6.5 minutes left. Time goes fast. I want to turn to not away from Iraq a little bit to the larger issue of Trump's foreign policy. It's all tied together. Certainly, Trump has been saying on the campaign trail and since he's been elected president and in the face of extreme hostility from the mainstream U.S. media that he wants to improve relations with Russia. At the same time, he's and his top cabinet members have been targeting Iran with all kinds of verbal attacks. And of course, Iran is an important ally of Russia in the Middle East. But then there's the other part of Trump's foreign policy, which is to show strength. And strength in Iraq means sort of overcoming what he characterizes as Obama's weakness. And he sort of asserts that ISIS got strong because Obama was weak, not because the U.S. had invaded Iraq, but because Obama was weak. There's another place where he's demonstrating strength, he thinks, and that's in the question of nuclear arms and a new arms race. And I want to turn to this in our last 5 minutes or so, because the Russian government, including leaders in the Russian Senate, who have been somewhat hopeful or cautiously optimistic that Trump would mean something different, are taking umbrage at the idea that Trump wants to get rid of the START Treaty. Trump said it had a one-sided character. He said, let there be an arms race. He also said, quote, at the top of the United States was going to be, quote, at the top of the pack in terms of nuclear capacities and would, quote, never fall behind on nuclear power. And then made other references to or suggestions that nuclear arms or a nuclear arms race could be a leverage point in negotiations with Russia, which Russia says absolutely not, that this is the Russian government will not deal with its own national security as sort of a negotiating chip. Talk about how you think this will play out in the coming weeks. It's very hard to know, of course, because it's all shaping right now.
Very hard to know, but I think one of the great problems with Donald Trump is that I don't think he's formed his own ideas very clearly, but I do think he has certain very strong instincts, and I think those instincts always are to put himself and the United States in what he sees as the best possible position. So I think he thinks that he has more levers to pull where the Russians are concerned than he actually does. I think he thinks that the Russians are prepared to make all kinds of concessions, basically, to get on the good side of the United States by dropping Iran, by agreeing to his ideas on strategic weapons and all the rest. And I think he may very well find, quite soon down the line, that that isn't really the case at all, and that the Russians have their own ideas, and that they don't really correspond with his. And that is where I think we're going to see how serious he really is about wanting good relations with Russia, and what his conception of those good relations is, and whether he wants those good relations for themselves, or whether it's essentially another exercise in manipulation, as I said, to just put the United States in a better position of advantage. Certainly, I do not think that the Russians are in any mood to make any kind of unilateral concessions to Donald Trump or to the United States in order to improve relations. I think they will want a very structured negotiation. They will want certain things in return. I'm not quite sure what those are, but I'm sure they do. I'm sure they will have certain ideas, and I will suspect also that they will treat this whole business of what Trump was very carefully indeed. As of this moment in time, there aren't even many contacts, it seems, between the Russians and the Americans, and I think that the Russians are looking forward to having those contacts because I think they want to have a clearer picture of where Trump is actually heading. But as I said, unilateral concessions from the Russians, I don't see them. And I'm sure that's what Donald Trump is going to find for himself very soon.
Ben Norton, we have 2 minutes left. I want to ask you the same question, of course, because these are the two hotspots, Iraq and Syria. That's one. And also the U.S. relations with Russia on big global issues, such as what happens in Ukraine, or especially what happens with a new arms race. Of course, Obama modernized the U.S. nuclear weapons, spent $1 trillion. It wasn't, quote, being weak. They were in violation of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty with a whole new modernization and a whole new generation of nuclear weapons that would be more usable with adjustable yields, making them more applicable for battlefield situations, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, that would provoke both Russia and China or any nuclear power to take countermeasures. The chairperson of the Russian lower house of parliament said it is necessary to maintain the core principles of nuclear parity. The dominance of one power is unacceptable because otherwise the whole system of international security will be askew and the efforts on the nonproliferation front of the last decades will be rendered unimportant. And the Slutsky, Leonid Slutsky, that person, the chairperson of the Russian lower house, was making that in response to Trump's sort of cavalier announcements about let's get rid of the START treaty and let's have an arms race. How can the U.S. cooperate with Russia in Iraq and Syria and take that kind of policy in matters that are directly threatening to Russia? 1 minute.
Well, at the end of the day, the circle can't be squared, right? And Trump is trying to pursue a contradictory policy. And at the end of the day, he's going to have to choose one side. The Wall Street Journal recently published a very interesting report interviewing officials inside both the Russian and U.S. governments. And it said that the Trump administration was pursuing a strategy of trying to make a wedge between Russia and Iran and essentially telling Russia, we, you know, will consider rapprochement and maybe even lifting sanctions if you move away from Iran. Russia, of course, is divided internally in the government, but Iran is an ally of Russia, and that is not likely to happen. I mean, that's an uphill battle. So it's, of course, too soon to tell right now. But I think at the end of the day, someone is going to have to budge. And Trump is not a consistent anti-imperialist. He's not, you know, he's not devoted to particular political positions on principle when it comes to foreign policy. He is America first. And if he decides that being allied with Russia is good for his America first position, then he will do it. If he decides that being allied with Russia is not a good idea, then he's going to, you know, continue the aggression against Russia. So, I mean, it's really hard to tell. And I think we should be very skeptical of the notion that, one, the U.S. government and the deep state would allow rapprochement with Russia, and two, that could be consistent with what Trump is trying to do in the Middle East otherwise. I mean, again, there's a contradiction there that needs to be resolved, and we'll see how it does get resolved.
Okay, excellent discussion. We've been talking with Alexander Mercuris. He's the editor-in-chief of the Duran. He was joining us from London. We're also been joined from New York City by Ben Norton, currently a contributor to Alternet's Gray Zone Project. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.